30% of physicians have depression, 10% of physicians have had suicidal ideation, and 1 to 2.5% have attempted suicide. Relative to how big it is, we don't hear about it all that much.
Off the Chart, a business and medicine podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices. My name is Austin Luttrell. I'm the assistant editor of Medical Economics, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. In today's episode, Medical Economics senior editor Richard Perrichin speaks with Dr. Daniel Sadawi-Kanefka, an anesthesiologist, co-founder and president of the Emotional PVE Project, and Dr. Christine Yumoutier, a psychiatrist and chief medical officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. They're co-authors of a recent JAMA paper on reducing barriers to mental health care for physicians. In this conversation, they're going to discuss why stigma, culture, and outdated licensing practices still keep many physicians from getting the help that they need. They'll also talk about what meaningful change looks like, from reforming credentialing questions to improving mental health education in medical school. Dr. Sadawi-Kanefka and Dr. Moutier, thank you both so much for joining us, and now let's get into the episode.
Thank you both for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Regarding the article, with the special communication, it was a great summary, I thought, of, like I said, challenges and resources. Can you talk a little bit about how that came about and why it was important to bring this to public attention yet again?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess on a personal note, I serve as the program director for the anesthesiology residency at Mass General. And I've seen firsthand how mental health conditions get ignored or sort of framed as just a phase, something that'll pass. I see how it gets in the way of performance and well-being. And then more personally, I've lost colleagues and mentees to suicide. And seeing these barriers and this treatment gap became something that was very personal and something that I felt we really ought to be able to improve.
Yeah, very similar for me. Just, you know, many, many years in academic medicine of experiencing a disconnect between the real struggles and real human issues physicians and trainees face and kind of the environment and how that was being addressed at the time. And a lot has been changing over the years, but I think we felt this subject was timely because a lot of efforts are ongoing, maybe a bit fractured, and that it was time for kind of a summing up of where is the sort of state of things at this present time. And certainly in this kind of post-COVID era, the mental health of physicians and other health workers as well could not be of more importance still. We're not over. And we always had said during COVID that the effects of this pandemic are going to be felt in terms of a mental health kind of repercussion for a long time to come. And I think we're, you know, whether you frame it in terms of COVID or other things, we're still definitely in the thick of it.
You know, that's a great segue. And to continue along maybe with that thought, both of you, would you take a moment and in your own words, how would you describe the current state of mental health among physicians and other clinicians in the United States?
What strikes me about the data is how hidden the mental health struggles are. It's around 30% of physicians have depression, 10% of physicians have had suicidal ideation, and 1 to 2.5% have attempted suicide. Those numbers are incredibly high. You know, amongst trainees in the U.S., suicide is the leading cause of death. But relative to how big it is, we don't hear about it all that much. And I think the silence around the statistics really underscores how deeply embedded the stigma is and the barriers to help seeking are overall. It's fewer than one third of physicians will actually seek help for bona fide mental health conditions that could really benefit from help.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that silence around these issues is particularly vexing when, as a field, most organizations and leaders are trying to do something about it and actually care a great deal. And yet, the culture, the pressures, the policies, any number of real, complicated issues that we try to break down in terms of the solutions potentially to these barriers, they're still creating that tremendous gap between suffering, and the ability to access treatment and care and support like we would for any other type of health issue. So, yeah, we're very pleased that our kind of summing up of this was put forth by JAMA.
And you know what, Doctor, in our earlier conversation, this goes back to a couple of years ago, and I remember the point well, because you made a distinction between mental health conditions and workplace burnout. And even in that special communication, you wrote that critically differentiating burnout from diagnosable mental health conditions is essential for appropriately addressing physician mental health. Can you discuss that distinction and why appropriate recognition is so important?
Yeah, and I'm coming at this, I've devoted my life and my career now to suicide prevention. So of course I'm coming at this through the lens of the issues that elevate risk for suicide and the things that we can do about that. And the biggest concern I would say that I have around any conflating between burnout, which is its own serious issue and experience, and clinical depression is that there has been, I think, a sort of, well, they can co-occur, first of all, and there is some overlap in the symptoms and the experience. But when burnout is more normalized and acceptable to talk about, then we might miss the opportunity to actually have treatment that could make a huge difference for the person's life and actually could be life-saving. So there is data now that is a little bit more clear and helps us to understand that amongst, for example, in a UCSD study that I was a part of, amongst a sample of more than 2,000 health workers, it included more than just physicians, but health workers overall, about 52% met screening criteria for burnout and about 48% met criteria for depression. And then there was quite a bit of overlap. 33% had both, again, by screening criteria. But what was the most important kind of compelling finding is that it was only the health workers who had the depression, whether or not burnout was present alongside it or not, who were at greater risk for suicidal ideation and other risk factors for suicide, like hopelessness and very dire, extreme emotional states and anxiety and desperation. So burnout had been discussed in some parts of the literature as a risk factor for suicide, but and it could be for some, it could be along their path of risk, but on its own is probably not strong enough that I would consider it a strong risk factor for suicide. So, again, the most important thing being that recognizing a treatable health condition that's potentially life-threatening is an essential thing to do and to not get that conflated with burnout.
I'll add just a quick thing. Just in talking with my residents, other physicians, these days it's almost as though burnout hasn't come to mean burnout. Any form of distress is just called burned out. Oh, I'm feeling a little burnt out. And really, what they mean to be saying is that they're feeling distressed. And to Dr. Moutier's point, if we call all of it burnout, well, burnout requires organizational and systemic solutions. Whereas mental health conditions, the treatment's individual. It's psychotherapy and medications at times, and so if everything gets relegated to all forms of distress are just called burnout, then we have physicians who are foregoing or delaying really critical therapies that could not only help prevent suicide but dramatically improve their quality of life.
I think it's a great point, and hopefully we'll have a few minutes to touch on both some of those systemic conditions and some of the individual ones that may have an influence. So far in our conversation, I think you touched on this, and the article also mentions about the culture of medicine. Definitely wanted to ask, how does the culture of medicine, including those long hours, perfectionism, and reluctance to show vulnerability, contribute to clinician mental health struggles?
So we have a culture in medicine that's long rewarded stoicism and stress endurance, and really has discouraged any acknowledgement of personal vulnerabilities. In fact, it's not even just that inadequate care is normalized. It's almost historically been celebrated. It's a badge of honor to work through illness. I know a mantra that I heard not. And I think I was of a vintage that it wasn't really like pushed on me, but I definitely heard the saying, you know, if you cough up a lung, you shove it back in and you get back to work, and that being sort of the things that people would say with pride. So this culture creates this hero narrative, this invincibility complex that unfortunately gets in the way of physicians being able to show vulnerabilities and follow that up with seeking help for conditions that would benefit from help.
I'll just add that in the broader societal culture, we already are dealing with a bit of a challenge in terms of the stigma and misunderstanding of mental health and mental health conditions. When you look at just the staggering sort of statistics that one in four Americans will have a mental health condition. It's just these are matters of human health. Whether it's genetics, early childhood trauma, any number of biological, psychological, social, environmental forces at play, just like for any health issue. So we as physicians are human beings, and then we come into an environment where that culture of toughness and stoicism had driven people with. And look, and while also we're going to medical school and training right during those years when the onset of mental health conditions, 75% of those mental health conditions will have their onset by age 24. And we're not recognizing the majority of them because we're writing them off to stress and other things. So you kind of have a convergence of just human factors along with an environment in training and in practice that was really misconstruing reality, I would say. And I'll just point to an interesting part of our history that had driven so much of mental health suffering and conditions underground that by the time they showed up and the field of medicine had developed more specific pathways for physicians who were dealing with substance abuse and addiction problems. But again, by the time they surfaced, they were like stage four and required, intervention, and there was impairment going on. And so I think there was actually a learned, a kind of a learned experience in the environment that taught some very incorrect assumptions about mental health conditions, which is that the large majority of physicians don't have them. If they're in our environment, I was even asked the question when I started the education program with that was part of the HEAR program, a suicide prevention program at UCSD, asked the question, well, if these distress indicators are true, then our admissions process must not be doing their job. So there was an assumption that we could sort of screen out these problems. So it was a really like stigmatized view of these human health matters of mental health conditions. The truth is, in terms of impairment, the vast majority of people with mental health conditions do not have a form of work impairment, just like that would be true for, people with diabetes or hypertension. And the earlier you address it, of course, the more likely it will not interfere with work as far as big eye impairment. Of course, it affects, more subtle aspects of performance.
You know what? Another really great segue to something that I wanted to ask about, because clearly there are workplace conditions. I want to phrase this the right way, I guess, but there's recognition, for example, for some physicians who may be in the workplace. But to take it a step back even earlier, so to speak, medical schools and their instructors are responsible for training new doctors and hold them to a high standard, to be sure, but there's also passing on those elements of that culture. For medical schools and instruction, what should be that role in addressing mental health, wellness, and well-being for physicians?
Well, there is a requirement for American medical schools to actually address well-being and issues of mental health and have a supportive culture and policies and very specific requirements around faculty who have evaluative roles to not be treating, clinically treating medical students with mental health conditions. So there are very specific sort of a framework that's required in order for medical schools to keep their accreditation.
I'll add, it's a really good question, Richard, because we know that fear of stigma, the desire for confidentiality increases substantially even during med school. Med students come in with only about 30% of them being worried about the fear of stigma. It becomes over half of them by the time they finish training. So it is a really important thing. I think a lot of med schools, thankfully, are focused on improving the well-being of their students. I think a lot of the focus, at least is my impression, not working in UME, but a lot of it does seem to focus on decreasing the discomforts associated with training, and that's critically important. I think if we were to consider well-being more holistically, it should also include curricula around the, as Dr. Moutier was saying, the commonality of these conditions, and also in those curricula. The importance and the benefits of seeking help for these things, and probably also just as important, training on how to recognize distress in yourself that might benefit from help. So I think med schools have a significant focus on well-being, and I think a lot of them are doing exceptional things. And I think there's still an opportunity to elevate nationally the curricula around mental health and med students.
Yeah, and if you make it part of the curriculum rather than kind of a side topic, I think you really normalize and elevate the importance that this is part of professional development and training to recognize these as serious matters, to become proactive about it for ourselves as well as for our colleagues, and to really learn how to be a support to others. And you know, it's an interesting thing to start, because I was a dean in a medical school, to realize that modeling a level of human vulnerability does not lower your reputation or your ability to be effective. In fact, I think that's a very powerful way for educators and clinical leaders to actually move the needle and create psychologically safe environments so that all the people who work on and learn under their unit leadership can see that it's okay to be fully human and to address your health needs, to address your family's needs, and that there's a way to do that even with the busyness of a physician's life.
And one point in the article really caught my eye also when you wrote that many physicians overestimate their ability to manage their health independently. Self-medicating behavior is common. How frequently does that occur, and what risks does that create, for the physician, for their occupational status, and for patient care?
Well, in terms of how common it is, the published reports show that between 9 and 15% of physicians report having self-prescribed antidepressants at some point. And that's not a sample of physicians with depression. That's a general sample of physicians. An additional 7% report getting antidepressant prescriptions informally from colleagues who are not in treatment roles. I'll talk about maybe some of the risks there. I think Dr. Mutia will probably have more to add. I see some significant ones for personal health in terms of bypassing proper diagnostic evaluation, treating the wrong conditions, approach to medication management, those sorts of things. There's also, because of state medical board regulations, some potential legal vulnerabilities from self-prescribing these medications as well.
The the suicide literature for physician suicide decedents versus the general population decedents shows that physicians are who die by suicide are as likely to have been suffering from a mental health condition, but are less likely to have been in any kind of formal treatment. And in fact, the self-prescribing may sort of thwart and divert from getting actual treatment, because what we might do in the short term is try to treat the short-term symptoms of insomnia or anxiety. That may really actually prohibit the ability to have that full assessment to understand what is actually going on. There's still stigma amongst physicians to see a psychiatrist and to get a full assessment, just like you would if you were, what you know, you weren't sure if it was a physical health matter, a serious one. You would go to a specialist and you would find the one that you trust and work with them. And so the other thing in the suicide literature that's very concerning is that the method of death is much higher in terms of toxic substances being there in the toxicity reports for physician suicide decedents. So I actually view it as something that is an issue of a high importance that can present dangers for individuals, because when you're not well and you're trying to self-manage, that can really, lead to not only ineffective treatment, but actually increasing the dangers and the risks.
One of the things that I definitely wanted to ask about, and you had noted in the article, the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation and other organizations have pushed for substantial change toward limiting disclosure of mental health treatment for licensing and credentialing purposes. You've already touched on stigma in our conversation. How important are those efforts, and what needs to continue to happen for additional success on that in the future?
I really think this is one of the linchpins of that is changing, thankfully, and must change in order for stigma to actually have a chance at really coming down more dramatically. Now, the laws changing and the questions that physicians and nurses are being asked on licensure forms and recertification forms are really critically important to treat mental health just like physical health. Not make assumptions of impairment. The questions should either not be there at all, or they should function. They should center around impairment related to any health cause, and rather than singling out mental health, because there's really some loaded assumptions built in there. I think the thing is, that effort is important and must continue to full, to get to all of the states. Hospitals also need to change their privileging questions along those same lines, and that's kind of a separate advocacy effort. That again, the Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation has been very effective at creating a toolkit that's simple enough to actually make those changes happen. I think the next stage that really needs to happen is a communication strategy so that physicians who are in various hospitals and states understand what their conditions are. And if they are in an environment where it will not even be probed if you go to treatment. And of course, that's back to the self-prescribing and the informal curbside stuff. That is in part because of this great fear. So we do need to know that era is over, and we have some ways to go with that yet, but it's a very, very critically important part of this work.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. The one of the sort of landmark articles, as I see it, that came out in 2018-ish was that in states that ask those questions, physicians are 21% more reluctant to seek care. So it's not just a hypothetical or something that we postulate. It's they're less likely to seek care. And I'll also echo that I think it's sort of like a critical first step, because we if that culture and these applications persists, it sort of gives life to all the stigma that follows. Now, I will say that even if all of the licenses and credentialing applications and malpractice insurance and commercial insurance, even if all of those were fixed today, we would still have issues with stigma, issues with fear of getting jobs or getting into different residency programs. We'd still have the culture of stoicism, and we'd still have logistical barriers. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but it's such a critically important first step that it's fantastic that so many groups have been focused so intently on making sure that that's taken care of.
Your article includes a concise multi-level approach for overcoming barriers and seeking help. There were numerous options that you outlined, and wanted to ask both of you if there was one you'd really like to highlight.
Oh gosh, it's hard to pick just one. I guess the way that I would look at approaching this important topic is to, if you're a leader in a hospital or in a training program, don't go it alone. Find a team of like-minded people who care deeply and passionately. Try to get leadership buy-in and approach this as a sustained strategic effort over months to years, not as a one and done kind of, this isn't something where we can flip a switch and have all the solutions ready to go, unfortunately. But most important things don't work that way. I think I will just highlight the anonymous screening programs, like AFSP's interactive screening program, that can make a huge difference in terms of lowering the barrier to disclosing that you're actually suffering and having the opportunity to engage with someone who can lead the individual to sort of customized best next safe resources, because it does need to feel psychologically safe.
That's actually perfect. I was going between that one and one other one, so you guess I'll be able to share spotlight the other one. I think opt-out programs have significant potential. So opt-out programs, they reverse the paradigm. Rather than waiting for distress to happen for certain groups, the default is actually care therapy is actually set up. It's part of the curriculum. I see this as kind of, you turn 45, you get your colonoscopy. It's not because you're a bad person. It's because you're at risk, and we look for stuff because we care about you. And so these by changing the default from requiring physicians to actively seeking help to just making it a standard part of training or practice, I think it overcomes a number of the different barriers. It normalizes help seeking, it takes away the fear of professional repercussions, and it gets over the logistical challenges because it's just embedded in the curricula. Now obviously it has a some challenges in implementing because logistically and funding wise, it's one of the more expensive options. So maybe the more pragmatic solution there or approach would be to really prioritize vulnerable populations. So trainees, or we know that suicidality increases threefold in the wake of medical errors. So maybe it's just part of standard approaches to legal proceedings or in the wake of medical errors. But that'd be
I
the other one
mean,
that I'd highlight.
we also saw in the latest ACGME mortality study that came out in 2025 that the first quarter of the academic year appears to be the most vulnerable period for suicide risk for residents. So that's another consideration.
I'm Richard Peyrchin, reporting for Medical Economics. Mike, I've had two guests here today, Dr. Christine Yu Moutier and Dr. Dan Sadawi Konefka, our co-authors on a special communication that outlines the state of mental health challenges and resources for physicians. It's been a great conversation. Thank you both so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Once again, that was a conversation between medical economics senior editor Richard Peyrchin, Dr. Daniel Sadawi Kanefka, an anesthesiologist and president of the Emotional PPE Project, and Dr. Christine Yamoutier, psychiatrist and CMO of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. My name is Austin Luttrell, and on behalf of the whole medical economics and physicians practice teams, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show and ask that you please subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Be sure to check back on Monday and Thursday mornings for the latest conversations with healthcare experts, sharing strategies, stories, and solutions for your practice. You can find us by searching Off the Chart wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you'd like the best stories that medical economics and physicians practice publish delivered straight to your email 6 days of the week, subscribe to our newsletters at medicaleconomics.com and physicianspractice.com. Off the Chart, a Business of Medicine podcast, is executive produced by Chris Mazzolini and Keith Reynolds and produced by Austin Luttrell. Medical Economics and Physicians Practice are both members of the MJH Life Sciences family. Thank you.